You are listening to Secret Handshake, the podcast covering the movies that help you identify your friends and maybe make a few more along the way. Coming up, Spine number 61, George Miller's epic wasteland melodrama, The Mad Max Saga. Featuring Goose, The Knight Rider, Toe Cutter, Fifi, Mudguts, Wes, The Gyro Captain, Toady, Pig Killer, Master Blaster, Anti-Entity, Nux, Rictus Erectus, Scrotus, The Doof Warrior, Immortan Joe, Praetorian Jack, Dr. Dementis, and the Darkest of Angels herself, Imperator Furiosa. Martin.
Yes.
Do you have it in you to make it epic? Welcome back to another edition of Secret Handshake. I'm your host, Jacob Knight, and joining me as always is Martin Carlson. Martin, you ready to ride to Valhalla, shiny and chrome?
Indeed.
We're doing the Mad Max movies because, as you might guess, Furiosa just dropped in theaters, and it's kind of taken film Twitter and film critics, basically everything but the box office, by storm. And we just really wanted to celebrate it because we love all of these movies. Martin, can you take me to your initial experience with the original Mad Max in 79? I know you weren't alive yet, but like, what was your first time seeing these movies?
Well, my first one I saw was actually Thunderdome. And
really?
Yeah, because
mine wasn't Mad Max either, so.
Yeah, mine was Thunderdome. It was that same era. It was like the mid, because it was like, what, 85? It was mid-80s. Films like, my parents were showing me Tron, and they were showing me Willow. They were showing Neverending Story. And it kind of fit in well with like these like big, like high fantasy kind of films. My first introduction was not as like what I learned was the true Mad Max, like, kind of environment and milieu. It was this kind of more kid-based, more high adventure kind of thing. And then I ended up...
It was your version of the prequels.
I mean, no, seriously. And we were texting about that. I think that, like, and we'll get to specifically Thunderdome in a little bit here, but, like, I think one of the reasons I still have an affinity for it is, like, again, it's another of those movies I can't separate nostalgia from it. Like, it brings you back. My brother and I liked it. Like, it was, we loved the fight with Master Blaster. And then I saw Mad Max next because it was like at Walmart, one of those, like, because it was easy to get, like, a almost like, it wasn't public domain, but it might as well have been, these shitty VHSs.
Well, because it was one of those movies that changed hands on home video because it was American International.
Yeah.
And then once Warner Brothers puts out the Road Warrior, basically the Road Warrior, Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome, and everything kind of from in the series moving forward. But even like Mad Max Now, where the rest of those titles are all on Warner Brothers Blu-rays. Like, I watched Mad Max on a Shout Factory Blu-ray because the rights are different.
Yeah.
So, and they come through a different company. It's kind of always been like that, stretching all the way back through VHS and even like its theatrical distribution.
Yeah, it was kind of an interesting, similar experience to when I saw, when I went back and saw Evil Dead 1 for the first time after having seen Army of Darkness first, then I saw Evil Dead 2, and I saw Evil Dead 1, like, last. And it was this kind of, like, to see where it all came from. And Mad Max feels similar to that. It's definitely smaller in scale, but you can still see, like, the seed of what will become this entire world. Like, you can see that his imagination is already bigger than his budget, and, yeah.
Or his resources.
Resources is what I'm looking for, yeah.
Because, yeah, Mad Max is one of the ultimate kind of DIY, Ozploitation movies that really put Australia's film industry on the map, like, and created an entire wave of knockoffs from, you know, the kind of Italian movies that we really like The Bronx Warriors, all those Fred Williamson post-apocalyptic titles.
Yeah, New Barbarians.
New Barbarians.
My favorite.
The Enzo Castellari movies. Like, it made those. And then there was a whole wave of movies even in Australia with stuff like Dead End Drive-In, which is a really good one.
I love that. Yeah, Trenchard Smith did a lot of, like, George Miller kind of rip-off stuff.
Yeah, and even Peter Weir, which this is, I believe, pre-Mad Max with something like The Cars That Ate Paris.
Agreed, yeah.
And that's like 77 or 78, I want to say. But obviously, like, these are all extensions of, like, the car culture that is big in Australia, to where even George Miller and Brian Trenchard Smith and stuff, if you ever watch Not Quite Hollywood, they talk about how, like, this is just a representation of, like, an already kind of established pastime in Australia. It's that they love fast cars. They love this idea of, like, endless roads because they, you know, outside of the cities like Melbourne and everything, you really do have these stretches of wasteland. So, like, you can see why George Miller's imagination and then the imaginations of guys like Brian Trenchard Smith and stuff were set on fire by this idea of just, like, we have this apocalyptic landscape to already play with, that, like, the possibilities are kind of endless and what we can build on.
Yeah, you could see them, like, these films and a lot of, I mean, we both love exploitation, but talk about having this amazing environment where your production design is free.
Yeah.
Right. You're living in a place where
it's your whole country is the Spahn Ranch.
No, it's Western. And you think about when we get to Road Warrior, I mean, he's able to get these, like, David Lean-esque scenes, but, like, there's not, besides, like, 30 cars and then one set, it's just like the location is where the money's at. And, you know,
it's endless horizon.
Absolutely. It's gorgeous.
And Road Warrior, if we're going to talk about our first experiences with the series, like, Road Warrior was mine. And I believe it was on Monster Vision with Joe Bob Briggs. It was one of the ones that he programmed. And I remember watching it on, like, TNT and being like, holy shit, what the fuck is this? Because even though it's R-rated, like, Road Warrior, there's no real nudity in it.
There's the one sex rape scene at the beginning. But
even that's, like,
it's through
you
through
can cut through around that pretty easily. Like, there's no real gore, and even the gore that it does have, like, is basically the metal boomerang that takes off that one dude's fingers. And then
some arrow hits.
So, like, you, if you watch it on TNT, you're basically getting the same R-rated cut.
Yeah.
You know, because all the spectacle is just twisted metal the entire time, exploding tankers. And then this big bald Jason looking motherfucker named Lord Humongous.
Yep.
Who I remember, that was the dude most of all who captured my imagination, because it was just like, even at, like, 12 or 13 or however old I was when, you know, I first saw this movie, I remember that dude appeared on screen the first time and my brain just went, what's up with this motherfucker?
Well, I remember the thing that caught my eye too, I think I was probably, like, again, like 5 or 6 when I saw Thunderdome. I think I was probably like 10 or 11 when I saw Mad Max. And I was kind of the era I was making my way through a lot of just, like, 80s and 70s sci-fi. So that's when I first saw, like, Highlander. I was kind of making my way, like, down the list. And the interesting thing about even back to Mad Max, and it goes all the way, is a lot of, like, gender fluid kind of characters in his, like, in these gangs. Like, you have his right-hand man in Mad Max, I forget his name, the blonde, who's quite effeminate. But then you get to, like, you know, Wes's partner, who's full on, I believe, like, almost like a trans, one of the first trans characters I remember seeing in cinema. So there was already this kind of otherworldly thing that he was showing, things I'd never seen in, like, 1992.
Well, and, like, the Marauders, like, you have the different kind of types that make up these gangs. Is you have, like, the Smegma Crazies. Like, they all have insane names.
Yeah.
Like, George Miller is the greatest.
It's like the Warriors. It's like people, these gangs kind of things. Yeah.
But then you also have the Golden Youth, and then you have the Gay Boys, like, which are literally the leather bound bike riders who they say were essentially the police force. They were basically Max's colleagues that go on to become marauders in the desert, just on these motorcycles. But it's like he, like, I would love to talk to George Miller about sexuality and like how he views like representation and stuff, because it seems like not only gender, but like sexuality is kind of fluid with him.
Yeah.
To where it's just like, it almost seems like the ethos is in the wasteland, was it, what does it matter?
Oh,
it's
yeah.
Like you view all
it's
laws.
It's like jail, right? It's just like whatever you can do.
All laws are, well, it's not only that, you're almost like free to be your truest self. It's like all laws are gone. There, nobody's judging you. So if you want to throw on a hockey mask and run around in leather gear and yell at people through a microphone or a megaphone and just like, that's your persona now, fuck it. Go crazy, Lord Humongous. Well, live your life.
Well, and that he really, I feel like, mashes, he likes to put together contradictory characters, because like even the first time we're seeing this, I said Lord Humongous is really strong, but he's also really weak. Like, he's breathing heavily, he obviously has been infected by radiation, like you see his like bald, like it's not like a, he's got Voorhees scalp, he's got the vein pumping through with the wispy hair, and it's like underneath that mask he's probably deformed, we never see it, but its idea is while he's ripped, he's almost like he's a mutant, right? And it's like he can't, you don't see him use his physical power much. It's more in the car and his gun, you know?
Well, it's one of the recurring themes that'll kind of run through the entirety of the saga, is that the big bads of all of these movies are guys who, like, if we want to talk about how, like, you're allowed to be your truest self in terms of sexuality, if you notice, like, all of the leaders, quote-unquote, are the ones who are able to almost create these caricatures of themselves, and that's what leads them to inspire and control power around them. And Lord Humongous is kind of, he's not the first example. The Toe Cutter, who you have the same actor, Hugh Keyes Burns, who would play two of these big bads. He would play the Toe Cutter in Mad Max, and then he would play a Morton Joe in Fury Road.
Yeah.
So it's like, but all of these guys kind of almost create these larger-than-life personas that not only inspire, but also inspire fear. You know, because that's kind of the basis of what Miller's most interested in as these movies kind of go along, is like, how not only they become, like, it's almost like how we talked about with the Planet of the Apes movies be kind of feeling like an anthology series at times.
Yeah.
The Mad Max movies kind of feel like an anthology series at times too, because they become, especially as you go along, and especially once you get to Fury Road, they almost become these cinematic wasteland campfire tales, or like his version of, like, there's a reason that, like, they're, you know, the war boys and a Morton Joe are yelling about Valhalla and riding together and, like, you know, going into this afterlife that's already referenced in like Viking mythology, is that like, that's what Miller's interested in. These are his Vikings. These are his Greek gods. These people who have created these kind of almost like personas and backstories and caricatures of themselves in this wasteland, because that's it. There's nothing else out there except for them. So they might as well kind of rise to become like the things that people remember most. And when they tell these campfire tales, of course they're going to talk about Lord Humongous, this muscle-bound animal who all of a sudden like is so crazy he inspires like all of these bikers to kind of follow him. Or they're going to talk about a Morton Joe who's like almost like the Citadel's Trump with his two large,
I want to get to that in a bit. Yeah.
Or Master Blaster, who is literally like two people. It's a giant, like, hulking beast that has a little person who rides his shoulders and like actually speaks for him. Like, these, like, Miller's imagination is conjuring up his own, it's almost like his version of an Australian Iliad at times.
I mean, absolutely. And he was going to do like an Iliad, like, for a long time. And I totally agree with you. And what's interesting, I think I always forget watching these films, is how quickly the world fell in his mythology, because Max is alive in his like 20s in the original Mad Max, and if he's the same character. Now, Miller's not super worried about, you know,
continuity,
but In all these films, you'll see people talk about who they were before, right? And Dementis talks about it in Furiosa. It's like, I had a family. And this idea, like, to your point, too, about, like, gender fluidity is also, like, you can be whoever you want to be. Like, in this new world, you can create. I remember in college, there was a kid I knew, and he was this friend of mine, total wacky dude. And then I met someone from his high school who was like, you know, he wasn't like that at all in high school. It was like this kid went to college and reinvented himself. It was like that, mm-hmm. you know? And so it's like definitely a sense of, but also people using their trauma for good or for ill, right? There's, you know, you have, there's the speech at Road Warrior, which I love. It's the leader of the camp who says to Max, he's like, you lost somebody? I lost people too. We all fucking lost people. Like, do you think you hurt more than we did? No, we're all hurting equally. We're just choosing to do something good about it, you know?
Well, Lord Humongous actually says it at one point too. It's one of the few moments of humanity you actually get for this big pro wrestler dude is that, like, after Wes's partner dies, he's freaking out and Lord Humongous literally puts him almost in like a chokehold. And it's like, we've all lost people too, but we do it my way, you know, and you're just sitting there being like they all acknowledge that they were humans once, but now nobody can be human and survive in the wasteland. You can't be fully human, at least.
No, absolutely. I don't want to get too ahead to Fury Road, but there is that sense of Max when you're alone for so long in the wasteland that you have to become pure, his like one instinct to survive, right? And the whole film is about him coming back saying, Max, my name is Max, like becoming human again, like being around people and like coming back to life. And like, this sounds a little weird, but like I felt that way after COVID with like just like living alone and being alone for so long. I think we all got in that headspace, not as anywhere near like being in the wasteland, but it's that similar thing of like learning to be in civilization again, learning to be with other people again. Like, I don't think, you know, George Miller knew that was going to happen in 2015. You know?
Just came out of your door in like 2020 and started yelling, you're like, the gasoline,
the gasoline,
the gasoline. I live for the black juice.
But there was something I kept thinking about watching these films, and I had a great time. I mean, I really just love
They're so fucking awesome. There is not a bad, even with, there's one movie I don't like as much as the rest, but even revisiting it, I was like, it's hard to knock these films because they're just so much imagination on display in each and every one of them.
He is, you know, Hideo Kojima, the video game, you know, director and creator. He's friends with George Miller, and he's like, you know,
is there anyone cool he's not friends with?
No, George Miller's in Death Stranding too. He's a character. I'm very excited. He's like best friends with Mads Mikkelsen. So Hideo's like, he's living large, but, and Refn, they're best friends. And,
yeah.
But he was like saying, he's like, Miller is my God. And this is his Bible is the Mad Max saga. And I was thinking about that. And we just happened to just come back from, we just saw, a live, scoring of Dawn of the Dead with Goblin. It was super awesome with Claudio Simonetti and his group. Mm-hmm. And I thought there's two filmmakers, I think, in our like lifetime who totally created a new genre, and that is the zombie film of Romero and the post-apocalypse of Miller. That there's their version of, there have been post-apocalypse before that, but the version we all think of today, even when we think of zombie apocalypse, that's George Miller too. Any apocalyptic, like, you know, sawing, you know, putting shit around a baseball bat, that's George Miller. It all started, I feel like, that with him.
I think there would, the only place where I would push back that I think George Miller draws from a little bit is Harlan Ellison and A Boy and His Dog. I do think the Don Johnson movie, there is some of it, but no, you are correct.
Right.
In that, because that movie takes a much stranger turn, especially once it gets into the underground society and everything. But like, yeah, what we think of when it comes to like the wasteland, that belongs to Miller.
Yeah.
Just in the same way that like
the modern zombies,
like, if there wasn't Night of the Living Dead or Dawn of the Dead, specifically Dawn of the Dead, probably,
yeah,
you really would not have anything going forward in terms of zombie movies. Well, at least not how we know them.
Yeah, totally. Also very similar trajectory to those films as well, from Night, very small, do-it-yourself, Mad Max, to Road Warrior Dawn, similar, bigger, to, like, I think Day is a lot better film than Thunderdome. And obviously he had something more to say, which, you know, based on your conversation with me earlier, like, Miller didn't really want to do Thunderdome that much. It's probably the one out of the entire series that he was a little bit contractually obligated to do.
Well, and it's like that movie started as a Lord of the Flies movie that he wanted to do, and it got spun into a Mad Max movie. But then Byron Kennedy, his like cinematic brother in arms, dies in a helicopter crash, I want to say. And it just kind of took the wind out of Miller's sails completely.
Oh, man.
I think the other comparison that does fit that you've kind of already made is also the Evil Dead movies.
Yeah.
Is that like the original Mad Max is like kind of akin to Sam Raimi's Evil Dead. And then Road Warrior is like George Miller's Evil Dead 2, where it's like, ooh, I get to like expand on this world a little more. Now, the big difference though is that Mad Max 2 is exactly that. It's an expansion of the world, where Evil Dead 2 is kind of a redo, just with like a bigger budget.
And more comedy
and everything. But like the tonal differences, if we want to bring up the comedy part, between Mad Max and Mad Max 2, The Road Warrior, are like kind of vastly different, because the original Mad Max is a straight ahead, lo-fi kind of genre, like revenge riff that takes its time. It slow burns. It has some really good car chases like early on and everything, but it really takes most of the movie. Like it's 90 minutes long and it takes 80 of them to make its point.
Yeah. I like Mad Max as part of the group. It's still like, I mean, for what it is full of, like you said, imagination. It is a really well-made indie film. I mean, like you could see every dollar.
You can't believe that they're able to get away with those car stunts. Well, I mean, you could say that about all these movies, but particularly this one, because you know there were no safety guidelines being followed.
Well, I heard interviews with him many times. He's like, yeah, we didn't have like permits to shoot on those roads, specifically in Mad Max.
No, it's real outlaw cinema.
And I think that's what, to me, when these films are at their best, is he is an alchemist of like, or he's able to like court danger and like capture it on the cinema, and somehow still people don't die on his sets. Like it feels like he's been very lucky in that respect, especially
people have gotten injured,
but like Road Warrior and Mad Max in particular feel downright irresponsible.
Oh yeah.
Like there's shit in Road Warrior every time I watch it, because like the final push of just the chase with the tanker is some it comes out the year after in America, 82, right? After or 81, I guess in Australia. But see the same time frame as Raiders of the Lost Ark. A very similar setup of this like long, you know, chase movie, which is what Raiders ends up being too, especially the end, everything with that truck chase. But like, you know that Raiders was done by the book, by like, you know, big, huge budget Paramount movie with Spielberg, the hottest director in Hollywood. And this one is like, hey, I'm just down in Australia with like significantly less money, but it's crazier. It absolutely feels dangerous.
So I do have a question for you kind of along these lines. Do you think there are laws in Australia?
I don't think so, dude.
There are times where I was watching all these movies in a row. I was sitting there thinking like, you know, they don't show us anything outside of Australia. What if the rest of the world is just fine?
They're just...
And Australia just lost its fucking mind at some point.
Well, I think it's really interesting because like, you know, we were talking off mic just about randomly, but like we're both big fans of the film Wake and Fright, you know, another film about just like, just society crumbling so quickly and like in the span of like an evening or like,
well, that's, I'm half joking.
Yeah.
You know, fully joking. Yeah. Like obviously there are laws in Australia, but like, yeah, that's kind of what I'm getting at is a lot of these Ozploitation movies, especially the best ones like Wake and Fright, they get at how there's almost like primal DNA that's never left the Australian people. That, and especially when they get into the outback, into the outskirts of society, that anything's bound to happen, and you're really kind of almost susceptible to breaking down to your most primal self.
That's fair, and I think specifically with Mad Max, and I love watching this film as part of the series, as like kind of, again, a prequel, but it was made, you know, leading up, is at the end of civilization. It's not post-apocalyptic, it's like mid-apocalyptic, right? It's idea of like, you see, you know, these cops like Max and his and Goose and his friends who were like the last line of defense on the road.
Yeah, right? Like the apocalypse has totally started.
It started, and it's
because they're operating out of dilapidated, and you know, part of this is because of like the production limitations that Miller was essentially just scouting places and being like, oh, there's an abandoned building, we can shoot in that, mate.
Yeah, you know, the Hall, Hall of Justice. And
which is just like a dilapidated building.
It's so cool. But you can see, he's just got such an eye for it. But I think about the whole section, though, of like you're getting at, too, with like his wife, the scary stuff of her being like kind of the run-in with the toe cutter and his gang, is straight up Wake and Fright. It's straight up like, yeah, it's like Straw Dogs. It's like fucking Spit on Your Grave. It's like that kind of like,
it's exploitation, it's rape, revenge stuff.
It's just this woman's in danger. And it's like really well done in that respect. Like it's telling terrifying. That story, it's really scary. Everything of like her running into like the woods and everything, and like Max running after her barefoot. There's always this imagery that really sticks with you. And
with 21-year-old Mel Gibson.
He's 21.
Yeah, he's so young in that movie.
He's so beautiful in this movie, though. He's a handsome fucking man.
Road Warrior is like peak Gibson.
Oh man. Well, Road Warrior, yeah, I would say that, and then I mean the ultimate Lethal Weapon 1.
Oh yeah.
I just that's like Gibson, just you can't beat that look. That mullet. But I think that, like, that's why I like Mad Max, though, as well. It's just, like, that feeling of it's the slow unraveling of civilization throughout the film. It's, like, early on, you're like, okay, this seems like they're regular cops. Like, they're, like, kind of just doing their job. And Max has his home life. And it's, like, he's got a kid. And they're playing, his wife's playing saxophone.
I was going to bring that up. One of the most,
it's weird,
my favorite shots in the whole movie is that it almost seems like it's supposed to be part of the soundtrack or like part of the score. It's just this like soothing, bringing up Lethal Weapon, like this soothing kind of sexy sax. And it's like he's sitting there eating dinner with his kid at night and looking at his wife lovingly across the room. And then it goes through a reverse shot and she's the one just fucking ripping on the sax, but it's like between her legs and she's like gyrating on it. And you're sitting there being like, all right, like George Miller has a real interesting sense of humor about himself.
I think it's definitely for comedy's sake. And like to your point too, and it gets to Road Warrior, there's a especially with the gyro captain, I think Bruce Spence brings a real comedy, and the feral kid brings the whole like, it's basically Shane. I mean, he's a silent actor, but like it's the Shane story. It's Shane, like, you know, this guy from the desert comes in, tries to be civilized, and then decides he's going to leave, you know?
Well, I mean, and yeah, Mad Max is almost like High Noon to a certain degree.
Oh, yeah.
There's real gunslinger stuff going on in that, to where it's just like, especially like I love the setup of that opening kind of set piece with the Knight Rider.
Oh man.
Where the Knight Rider just starts going through all these different cops, and all these cops basically fall off, like trash their cars or whatever, like, or flip them, or they can't.
But they keep going. They'll be like, oh, we're done. Like, we're back in the game. And they get out again.
But the whole time Max is just kind of sitting by himself in his car, and you can tell he's just waiting. He's waiting. And they're asking, they're like, Max, where are you, Max? And he's like, I'm here. And he's just waiting to get involved. And when he finally does, you watch the Knight Rider's face, like, cause they realize, again, to get to the, like the mythic sense of these movies, once Max gets involved and that interceptor car is like on the Knight Rider's tail, you watch him be like, oh, fuck, I bit off more than I can chew at this point.
Yes.
And then it becomes about him annihilating the Knight Rider and starting this blood feud with Toe Cutter and his whole gang. But that's it. It's a gunslinger against a gang of outlaws. Like, they might as well be on horses, only instead of horses, they're these metal machines.
I think that's what, like, he's really, Miller's so good at finding, like, a simple story within a wild mythology. Like, he hangs, like, all these, like, details and, like, this really crazy, specific world on top of it. When he's at its best, he's just telling. I mean, like the story of Road Warrior couldn't be simpler either. It's almost plotless. It's a siege movie, right? It's literally like it's a castle, and like the fucking barbarians are outside saying, "We want your fucking food."
Yeah,
and we're like, "Oh, we got to take it out, and we got to make a run for it." That's it, you know. And it's Max deciding, or like it's the classic anti-hero, like, do I have to give a shit? I mean, like, it's the 80s.
Do I have to get involved? It's like, am I morally obligated yeah, character, to get involved? Yeah,
exactly.
And I think it's fair to say that Miller's almost more interested in incident than he is in plot.
I would say so. Yeah, yeah. But it's still, I mean, like,
it's still there.
It's still absolutely there. I mean, because Road Warrior just has, like, perfect action beats, perfect, like, story character beats of, like, Max saying, you know, everything he does, it's so well told. Everything from the beginning is like, I'm only helping you to get gasoline. Like he saves that guy's life outside of the camp. It's like, I'm only helping you. They bring him in, like, and he's like, hey, it's transactional for him. He's like, I'm not a bad guy, but I'm transactional. It's like, you pay me for what I did this to get what I want.
Well, by Road Warrior, you kind of like, you bring up Shane and everything, but you almost trade Westerns for samurais.
Oh, totally.
In that, like, Max is almost like the Yojimbo of the wasteland.
Yeah, totally. It's
I think that's where Beyond Thunderdome, for me at least, gets hung up a little bit, or at least I get hung up on Thunderdome is probably the more accurate way to say it, is that movie almost seems to be trying to shoehorn too much plot into it, and it becomes like episodic, to where it's almost like it forgets to be a Mad Max movie until the final third, when you get to an actual tanker chase. It's almost like Miller's like, well, did he or did he not want to make this movie? We don't really know, but it doesn't feel like he at least didn't want to make a traditional Mad Max film. He wanted to make something closer to like a Spielbergian fantasy adventure.
Or Lucas all the way.
Exactly. But like, it becomes episodic, to where like you get Max entering Barter Town, getting into Thunderdome, meeting Tina Turner's auntie character, meeting and fighting Master Blaster, and then escaping. And then it becomes him hanging out with all these like, it almost becomes like George Miller's Hook, which is where it really loses me, because it's him again. It's supposed to be Lord of the Flies, but it's Mad Max hanging out with Lord of the Flies. And then it becomes him going back to Barter Town. And that's when like the actual traditional kind of Mad Max chase kicks in. And it really isn't until that final third that you're like, oh yeah, it's almost like Miller woke up and was like, well, they know it's Mad Max. We got to give him a tanker chase at some point.
No, I felt the same way watching this film, because the number one problem is it's too fucking talky. Like, there's just way too much dialogue.
Particularly Max.
Max, you think about Road Warrior, and especially Road Warrior, like, he barely says anything. It's like, they joked about Anya Taylor-Joy has, like, 12 lines of dialogue in Furiosa. It's this thing in these movies, like, these heroes, they don't say much, they do, right? They do things. And it's their action is who they are. And this one is like from the beginning is like Max comes to Barter Town and is like talking. And it's all like world building from the beginning. It's like, make energy? It's pig shit. Okay. Oh, there's all these machinations of like, you got to kill Master Blasters so that I can take control of Barter Town. And it's just all this stuff where you're like,
there's almost a video game logic to it.
Oh, yeah. It's a fetch quest.
Right.
It's like, until you got to go get this thing to go do this thing. And it's beautifully shot by Dean Semler. It's a gorgeous movie. Like, it's absolutely beautiful.
Oh, yeah.
But it's just like, I totally agree with you. It just feels it. When Miller's at his best is it's silent world building.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, again, the story is simple and you see things. Like the milking women in like Fury Road, they don't like talk about it, right? It's like, it's just there. And you're like, okay, like they're making mother's milk. They're trying to make this basically breeding farm. It's all visually done. And your brain is still working overtime to pick up all the details of how everything works, but Thunderdome is hangs out in explanation. And
yeah, it's very expository.
Absolutely.
I mean, right down to even explaining the rules of Thunderdome.
It's just too much, yeah.
But it still has these moments, though, like when they strap them into the harnesses and they're flying around the Thunderdome and Max has a chainsaw at one point and shit. Is that you're watching and you're like, yeah, sure, whatever, man. It's really not until the movie kind of downshifts into the Lord of the Flies segment that it really loses me.
Yeah.
But to your point, like, it's still like, if you put it on silent and just looked at it, it's gorgeous. And it's gorgeous in a way most Hollywood big budget films are not anymore, which is funny because Dean Semler would go on to be like this massive Hollywood shooter, like gun for hire. But like the stuff that he shoots, you would never put in the same category as Beyond Thunderdome. Like, he shoots a lot of, like, Adam Sandler stuff, like The Ridiculous Six, Sandy Wexler. He shot Grudge Match with fucking De Niro and Stallone.
Oh, God.
Secretariat, Appaloosa, which I like that movie.
I do, too.
Apocalypto, which that makes sense, working with Mel Gibson again on his, Mayan chase movie, essentially. And then We Were Soldiers. But he also shot like stuff like The Nutty Professor 2, The Clumps. But then he did Waterworld, which makes total sense after doing Beyond Thunderdome. He has such a weird, varied career.
Well, that was so interesting is watching this film. And we've always known Waterworld is just Mad Max on the water. It's the pitch, right? It's the same story. But I realized Waterworld is Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome on the water.
Yeah.
Like all the stuff about trading, all the like expository time we spend with how this like civilization works on the water versus just letting him be out in the catamaran. Like that's where that movie gets bogged down. It makes the same mistake as Thunderdome.
Oh, 100%. Right?
It's just like all that time of just like, dude, why is he fucking, he's trapped in mud. Like, what are we doing here? But let's get him out on the water fighting Dennis Hopper.
Well, and by comparison, the stuff that he shot in Australia, at least a couple of these titles are like some of our all-time favorites, is that he does Mad Max 2, and he does Razorback, and he does Beyond Thunderdome.
Wait, similar shot Razorback?
Yeah.
I mean, he's gorgeous.
Well, that's what I mean. Like, he's done amazing work. He did The Coca-Cola Kid with Eric Roberts, nice, which is really good. Cocktail, Young Guns, Calm.
Oh, damn.
Dances with Wolves. Like, he did a lot of great stuff. And then at City Slickers, then at a certain point, Last Action Hero, at a certain point, he kind of just transitioned into just doing big studio, mainly almost like comedy.
That's a pretty movie, though, too, is Last Action Hero.
Right.
It's a well shot, very similar look. Yeah.
So he's got a lot of talent. But look, I mean, no offense, Dean Semler, wherever you are, it's unfair to say that trading Dean Semler for John Seal, Peter Weir's regular cinematographer, to shoot Mad Max Fury Road, I mean, that's kind of a big upgrade.
It's next level.
And like Fury Road, there's a reason why Fury Road looks the best out of all of these. As much as I even love Road War, and I think Road War is a gorgeous movie, no movie of the last 20 years has looked like Fury Road. Like, it's one of a kind.
Fury Road, I saw, so I was at South by 2015, it was March.
Okay.
They showed Road Warrior, and George Miller was there, and we all thought it was going to be the thing that happens at South by, where it's going to be like, surprise, we're showing you Fury Road. It happened with like the Star Trek movie instead of Wrath of Khan. It happened a couple times, and we're all just there hoping, we're like, oh my God. And like, I see George Miller, Rodriguez introduces him, and he's like, I'm not going to show you the whole movie, but he showed us a scene. And it was the first thing, it was the scene after after the sandstorm, and Max is in this, he's under the sand, and he wakes up, and it's that fight with Furiosa and the women and with Nux. And I'm watching it, and my brain can't even comprehend what I'm seeing, because it's like, beyond the photography, it's the way he directs action It's literally like he leveled up like a thousandfold since we last seen him done an action film. It blew my mind so much. And I was like, if the rest of the movie is like this, we're in for a fucking treat.
Well, and especially after hearing all of the horror stories leading up to that, to where like it seemed like Fury Road was never going to happen.
No, totally. Because I remember my brother sent me, this was like 2011 or 2012. He and I are both big Mad Max fans. And he followed a lot of these guys who would post about, you know, hey, working on a secret film down in this Australia or in South Africa. And it was these.
Because this was Namibia where he shoots this.
Yeah. And it was these builds for these cars for these. And everyone was like, it was like Mythbusters, I think. They had been invited down there or someone like that. And they're like, look at this fucking car with tank treads. I think it was like the Bullet Farmer's car.
Yeah.
And everyone's like, is that Mad Max? And so we were just seeing these images pop up online. And I heard the same thing because they lost their sets to a typhoon.
Yeah, there was a massive storm.
And they had to like reshoot a whole lot. They moved the set. Obviously, we were already hearing stories about Charlize Theron and Tom Hardy not getting along. That might have been after the fact.
That doesn't really come out until Buchanan's book, Blood and Chrome, the whole like oral history that he wrote about that movie. That's when a lot of those details.
That's right.
We had heard that they weren't having a good time, but it wasn't until. Like, honestly, the first signs of how bad it was for them didn't really crop up until Furiosa was announced. And it was like, oh, Charlize isn't coming back. And you were like, how bad was it for you then?
Yeah, to what we were talking about earlier, too, I think that what I love about George Miller is he's riding a fucking tornado. Like, he's riding a thunderstorm. Like, he's somehow capturing complete chaos on screen. And this movie is Road Warrior times 10. Like, like the shot we talked about in the car earlier of Max on the pole at the front of the screen.
And then the tanker's blowing up
behind is one of those shots. And for me, the entire, like, my favorite scene in this film is when they're making the run through the canyon. And there's the motorcycle guys bouncing up over on top of them, trying to drop these bombs on them. And it's this.
They look like Tusken Raiders on fucking motorcycles.
Exactly, with these like wicker like headdresses. And it's this, the way it's choreographed and the way that the shot selection is absolutely insane, where it's like Max reaching across Furiosa, shooting out one window, her popping out the top with this rifle, the music, the fucking Junkie XL score, which is mind blowing. And then it's them also, they put down the front like cow catcher to put out the fire on the front of the truck. And it's the music builds and then the valves at the front of the engine open up and you hear it breathe. And I literally was rewatching it a couple days ago and I would just go, oh, like it's so well put together. It's insane.
And apparently like his whole methodology is what drove Charlize and Tom Hardy insane. And then apparently the big story was that like Tom Hardy was always late to set
8 hours sometimes.
And Charlize finally lost it one day and freaked out. And I guess Hardy went after her like in like a very physical, intimidating and threatening way to where they had to have like an outside mediator come in and like basically get them to work together again. And like, it sounds like Fury Road was a fucking nightmare to make.
Yeah.
But it resulted in a masterpiece.
Yeah. It does like feel, again, there was like a chaos to the making of it, which comes across on the screen. Like while it is this beautiful big movie with like, you know, insane stunts and insane cinematography and music. It's about as epic as I can't think of a more epic movie. I mean, seriously, it's huge. And I think that what also makes it so special is it's one of the few films I've seen in the last, like you said, 20 years, and there's a good time frame where I said, here's a guy using all the technology available to him, but only if he has to. So it's like not reliant on CG when he doesn't need it.
Yeah, that was the big, is that it's supposedly, And obviously these numbers are completely invented, but it's all 80% like practical.
And you can tell.
It's all practical stunts. It's all practical driving, fighting, et cetera. And like CGI is literally just used to augment certain scenes.
To augment or for safety. There's a couple right. shots where it's like, but it's like, and to get some insane shots, you just
for
couldn't.
For safety.
Yeah, well, I mean, but
watch this fucking movie and you can't believe nobody died.
No, I mean, the
like shot. Hundreds of people
well, that, died. That one shot when he's on, when he's on the pole. No, he's been captured, that one guy, and he's being pushed down. His head is like right above the like,
yeah,
and he's just screaming and it's completely chaotic. And you know, you can tell though, like it makes sense that it's so storyboarded. You know what I mean? This is not a film shot for coverage at all.
No,
like, it is the, again, that scene with the bikers. You watch the, cause I've always heard Miller says, he goes, for me, cinema is like music.
Yeah.
It has to move like music. And
well,
you
he
watch
calls these rock and roll movies. It's like rock and roll cinema is his exact.
And you could tell, specifically yeah. with Fury Road, there's a rhythm. And I think that, you know, even rewatching Road Warrior, you know, early on in his career, like Cameron understands how to do big, 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 like Titanic, and then to zoom in for these moments. There's still like there's beats, you know, and I was talking to a friend after seeing Furiosa, and he, you know, he was saying that Fury Road was like too much for him. He said, oh, he's like, it's just so much over and over again. And I said, I get that, but I disagree, because
it is like an assault.
It's an assault, but there's still so much movement to it. Versus when I think of assault, I think of like Transformers. I think of like Michael Bay.
Yeah.
Just like without control. It's like, here's imagery. This feels like it's an assault, but it moves. There's moments. There's peaks and troughs of danger.
Yeah, there's
coming
a rhythm
out of
to
danger,
it. And it has a sense of purpose.
Yeah, and once you lock in for this movie, like it doesn't let you go. And I think even the low moments, the slow moments, are so beautiful in this film. Like the moment of Charlize coming to the green place and realizing it's gone, and like it has so much pathos, like that he's like. It's not that fucking Joss Whedon-y, you know, J.J. Abrams, like making a joke after every serious moment. He literally has Furiosa rip her fucking arm off, go into the dunes, drop to her knees, and scream as the music rises. I'm like, yes, fucking, it's operatic.
Yeah.
It's huge. Like, and he just goes for it, man. And somehow he's able to pull it off.
Well, and there's also a rhythm to the way the movies are basically like as a whole put out, because like you have Mad Max, which is obviously the first one, and this is before there was probably any idea of like sequels or anything on his mind, but that one's much slower, contemplative, has the vibe of like a 70s revenge film or an exploitation yeah. movie. And then it's immediately followed a couple years later by Road Warrior, which is a straight up chase movie. And then you
like
have
Vanishing Point.
That's what I mean. Like, yeah. It just goes,
yeah.
you know? But Fury Road does the same thing. But in between those, you have Beyond Thunderdome, which is slower, builds the world back up, gets you reacclimated to it. And then after that, now, granted, this is, what, 30 years later?
Yeah, 29.
Yeah. And when Fury Road comes out?
85 to
2015, 30.
Yep. Mm-hmm. 30, yep.
So you have a 30-year gap. Where he makes Witches of Eastwick, Happy Feet,
Babe, Pig,
the Babe movies. Like, he's
just
out
just
there
the
just
second
doing
one.
Stuff.
Yeah.
You know? And then he comes back and he makes Fury Road. But Fury Road still keeps, even though it's 30 years later, it keeps with the rhythm and the sequencing of the movies, is that it's a chase movie. It's almost like, and if Mel Gibson hadn't, probably not. I don't think you would ever get old Mel.
It would have been awesome.
It would have been interesting. I just don't know if it would have worked even with him there. But instead, you get Tom Hardy stepping into Max Rockatansky's shoes, and he's perfect in the role. But and it's almost like,
well, because it's Furiosa's movie.
Well, it's Furiosa's yeah. movie, but it's also recasting in a weird way, kind of reinforces the main thesis of what Miller's fascinated in the whole, like, it doesn't matter who plays Max. It doesn't, and like you recast Furiosa with Anya Taylor Joy, when you get to actual, you know, Furiosa Mad Max Saga, like, it doesn't matter who plays these characters because they're Greek gods. They're campfire tales. It's like whoever is in the moment, it's almost like somebody else is telling you the story now. So it doesn't matter if it's, you know, Mel Gibson or Tom Hardy or Charlize Theron or Anya Taylor-Joy, because it's the characters and the tale that matters instead of the actual actors, if that makes sense.
No, I mean, it totally makes total sense, because he doesn't seem beholden by, you know, IP filmmaking, the normal kind of chains, the shackles of like IP filmmaking of like, well, we got to have Chris Evans as Captain America. No one else can play it. You know, like that kind of thing. You know, it's about selling toys and about the image and posters and IP. And this is so much like, you're right. It's that epic feel in a weird way. Cause it is, in the post-apocalypse, it's like we've returned to an earlier time in our civilization. So it is this like similar to sword and sandal, Greek, Roman, Viking again. It's those kind of,
they're almost like cave paintings.
Yeah.
In the wasteland.
Well, yeah. And you have the first history of your history man, which we meet in Furiosa. And we've heard of the history man. You see the quote, you know, at the end of Mad Max Fury Road of, you know, who are we that, you know, wander in the wasteland, and you meet who these history men are. They're the ones kind of literally carrying on these tales. They're carrying on the tales, and they're it's interesting. They're kept by like the men in power, the idea that history is written by those who win.
Yeah, 100%. You know?
And so, and again, Miller, like, these films are, again, when, with Fury Road too, are packed with just mythology on screen of just like, what's that? What, how does that work? What is that? And it's just, you, if you just pause, it's just full of information. You know, he's like Ridley Scott in that way. He fills the frame. Also a heavy, Ridley also being a heavy storyboarder, the way he does his action scenes.
Yeah, 100%.
You know,
and then you also have in Fury Road one of the great bad guys of all time with Immortan Joe.
He's fantastic.
He's just Hugh Keyes Byrne. What's interesting about him is that he brings such a theatricality to both roles, because with the toe cutter, it's almost like he's doing Shakespeare, but in the Outback. Like, his whole line delivery is very elegant and menacing.
Do not become accustomed to water, or you will resent its absence.
You will resent its absence. Yeah, and then Immortan Joe, he just becomes Wasteland Trump. And he even has, like, in Fury Road, he only has one large adult son that we know of, with Rictus Erectus. But Furiosa, you get Scrotus thrown in there.
Who's Don Jr.?
Yeah.
He straight up looks like there's no way he's not Don Jr.
Eric and Don, and there's a real like dingus and dongus to them.
It's pretty funny.
You want to get to Furiosa?
Let's do it.
All right. And we're back talking about Furiosa, the latest installment in George Miller's Mad Max saga. Martin, we're going to start with you. How did you feel about this behemoth of a movie?
Not my favorite. I'll be honest, I was a little disappointed. I'm going to say something super unoriginal. A lot of reviews have said is it's really hard to come after Fury Road. I think that Fury Road, again, is a whole body high. Every time I watch it, I'm like, this is perfect. I can't think of another action, the sci-fi, anything of this century that tops it. I think Furiosa is really good, and there are moments that I love, and I love Anya Taylor-Joy. I think Hemsworth is fantastic in this movie.
He steals the whole film.
Every time he's on screen, it's like, this is awesome. I think my main problem with it was, and I've told you this off mic, is to the, what I was saying earlier about Fury Road being this perfect mix of, like, if they could do it practically, they did. This film has a lot of CGI in it. It really just, I couldn't unsee it. It's a lot of CGI. A lot of the action scenes do not seem as dangerous. They're still well directed.
But it's not an episode of Jackass.
I know. But I'm saying from...
I already feel my blood pressure rising.
I know. We've already gotten this fight off mic, but like, there's something about, again, the films that, again, Fury Road has a sense of, I don't want people to really be in danger, but it's like...
There's you kind of do.
No, I don't. I think that this
one... No, it's okay. That's why we watch these movies.
But yeah, it's like I like...
It's a staple of this subgenre that Miller's kind of invented, to your point, is that like... It feels like from Mad Max on, in the almost 50 years of him making these movies, it's amazing that nobody has died.
Right.
The only really Byron Kennedy died, and it was unrelated to the actual filmmaking.
Yes, and this one felt... a lot of the set pieces did not, it's a gut thing too, that like watching Fury Road, I felt completely from the first time I saw it to the last time I've seen it now, probably 20 times. Every time I watch it, it's just like watching it for the first time, and it just totally captures me. And you and other friends who loved Furiosa, I couldn't get on the wavelength of the film. I liked it, but I just didn't feel like I was aligned with it from the beginning. I think there's some kind of slow stuff early on. The segment with Praetorian Jack is my favorite segment, though. The two segments with him.
That's the best stuff in the movie.
I think that's the highlight. I just think their love, the silent, unspoken love. I think this film...
Actually, Tom Burke's so fucking good.
He's incendiary. He's so fucking smoldering in this movie. And like, I think that's an issue I had with this film too. I feel like it falls into some of the problems of Thunderdome, of a lot of explanation of like mythology and things happening. I'm just saying, again, it's a pretty talky movie, comparatively speaking.
Is it?
I think so. Yeah.
I mean, compared to Fury Road, sure.
Compared to Fury Road, compared to Road Warrior.
But it's nowhere near Thunderdome levels of talking. But it...
There's a lot. I'm just saying, you know?
So for me, this is how this movie plays. It's the Kill Bill Volume 2 to Fury Road's Volume 1.
That's fair.
And that it's the movie that deepens and enriches... something that you've seen before so that you understand it even more. And honestly, it even follows a very similar kind of structure to where Fury Road is almost like the House of Blue Leaves sequence
the whole
for
time.
2 hours.
Yeah.
You know, but like, you know, Volume 1's much more action oriented. It has the Vernita Green.
Look what we can do.
Yeah. It has Tarantino very much playing in action filmmaking for the first time, really the only time in his career. And then it ends with the House of Blue Leaves sequence, which is just a showstopper, you know, and that's a real look, ma, no hands kind of bit of filmmaking. I mean, that's all Fury Road is. It's just look, ma, no hands. I'm going to do everything practical. I'm going to blow this oil tanker up. I'm literally going to leave Steven Soderbergh speechless where he's made the comment, I would kill myself if I attempted to direct a movie like this, because he's literally like, I have no idea how George Miller made Fury Road and I do this for a living. So like, I get it. But like, the structure of Furiosa reminds me of Kill Bill Volume 2 a lot, right down to the, you know, the chapter titles, the mythology, the explaining of why she's essentially seeking revenge. Like, it's, you know, Dr. Dementis is almost like her Bill in a way.
Yeah.
You know, if like you think
I made you, you wouldn't exist without me.
Yeah. Like, and we're like, Praetorian Jack becomes her Pai Wei. Like, that's the, if you take it back to...
And her true love.
Yeah. But if you take it back to the idea of, like, the Road Warrior is more samurai than Western, like, this is a samurai film again, only it's about the rise of a samurai as she seeks revenge on those who, against her will, made her, to your point. And I, like, I was fully enraptured by this movie from, like, frame one. It just had me by the throat and didn't let me go for 3 fucking hours. I loved it. Now, to your point about the CGI, here's where my pushback against it. Even with all the CGI, and even if the mix between the practical nature of the stunts and driving and action and everything doesn't blend as seamlessly as it does with Fury Road, because there's far less of it in Fury Road, and it's really used as an augmentation. Where here, it is pretty front and center. Who fucking cares? Because, quite frankly, this movie still looks like nothing that's ever existed before. It's like, it's still totally operating on its own level of, like, myth-making and environment creation and, like, using it to create these set pieces. Like, that whole sniper sequence
with
the big rig where Praetorian Jack is driving around and Furiosa is just picking dudes off at the bullet farm. And Dr. Dementis is, like, trying to get them, like, just
is
take
it,
that.
Is it Dr. Dementis?
Yeah, it's Dr. Dementis.
Oh, shit. I thought it was just Dementis.
Is trying to take it down. Like, it's pretty fucking cool. Like, I don't care if those bullets that fall over him when he's, like, hanging from the ledge, like, look like they're CGI. Like, I've never seen anything like this before.
No, and that's a fair pushback. I think.
And, like, you just off mic were just telling me how good Black Panther,
oh fuck you,
and Winter Soldier are, and those movies look exactly alike. Like, because we've sat through so many, like, Marvel movies, they have a house style, they had a way that all of these are shot, regardless of whether it was the Russo brothers, or even if it was somebody as inventive as Ryan Coogler, or if it was Jon Favreau, or even if it was James Gunn, like, even the guys who had the most discernible style, Shane Black, like, they all looked alike. And they were CGI heavy movies to bring superheroes to life. This is kind of the same thing, only it's in service of, like, a filmmaking style that's totally unique and belongs to one person. It's like we've been talking a lot about the prequels lately, and we're prepping to do, I guess, spoiler alert, a prequel, Star Wars prequel kind of centered episode. And the one thing that we can agree on going back is one of the things that we've shortchanged George Lucas on in watching those movies now 20 something years on is that, sure, some of the CGI hasn't aged great, and, like, some of the creatures aren't great, and Jar Jar Binks is annoying, and Jake Lloyd is bad, but it's all in service of one dude's vision. And, like, we've kind of lost our, not only our taste for it, but our appetite completely as a culture, and that we're ready to throw, and this isn't just directed at you, this is directed in kind of the larger criticisms of the CGI in Furiosa, is that it's almost like we're ready to throw the baby out with the bathwater because it doesn't look like Fury Road. Well, I don't think it was supposed to. I think it was supposed to create this entire anti-reality that he had in his head.
I see what you're saying. I don't fully agree. I think that first of all, I still think that Furiosa is better than all that stuff. I like Furiosa. I like it a lot. But for me, it's the same. I see that you're very excited about this movie, and that's I'm
fired up, baby.
You're fired up, which is awesome.
This might be my number one movie of the year thus far.
That's all, and it's not for me. And I think that, again, I couldn't get on the wavelength of the movie, and part of that is the look. And you could say, oh, that's how it's supposed to look, but, like, there's something about, it's almost like, oh, not you too. You know what I mean? It's less about comparing it to Marvel. It's like, oh, why can't he do it too? There's just some scenes and stuff that just look bad to me. That they look shoddy to me. And
Which ones?
I think some of the War Rig scene honestly looks, some of the wide shots look bad. I think some shots, they, especially when Dementis is driving his big like monster, three world monster truck, they keep pushing in on him inside. And it's obviously he's not driving it. And it's this like really bad mat of Chris Hemsworth sitting in the seat. It's just stuff like that that kept taking me out of the movie.
His War Rig, I was questioning the physics of it or how it mechanically operated, because it's basically just like four motorcycles tied together.
Oh, not that one.
To a chariot. And I was just sitting there like, how does this work?
Yeah, that's not. I'm talking about his monster truck.
Oh, okay.
The one that it pushes in on there. But it's just, and again, like, I'm not trying to rip the movie on solely on that, but I think beyond the CGI, I totally intellectually get what you mean about the Kill Bill Volume 2. And actually, I think I like Volume 2 better than Volume 1. I like the expansion of the world. I love the more Western side of the kind of Kill Bill story versus the first part is very much more the Kung Fu.
I only view it as one movie.
But I just, if we had to...
Because I've actually seen the whole bloody affair.
Well, that's my good for you. Awesome.
But now I only view Fury Road and Furiosa as one movie.
Oh, fuck you. But like, you've ascended. I'm sorry, us plebs have to sit down here. No, but like, for me, it's again,
just gonna be me huffing the gasoline.
But
you just come over my apartment and I'm just ripping fumes of gasoline like, in there and watching Furiosa on a loop
and
screaming, like, witness me!
I'm like, oh, good God. But no, I think that in the end, for me, it's like, you said something that a couple, many episodes ago,
mm-hmm,
that I thought was really astute about how you and I view films differently.
Yeah, I'm sure it was very wise because I said it.
You said some great, it's always good shit. I mean, I just bask in it. But like you said, you know, with me, I'm much more, I like perfection. I like structure and like with films, right? I like things to like really move to a kind of perfect moment, and you like a little bit of like sometimes wildness with your movies. Like you like, you don't mind the mess, right? You can appreciate it.
And Miller is admittedly a very messy filmmaker.
Yeah. And I think
right down to his methodology.
And I think that this is probably just one of those times where, that's where we're separating, because Fury Road, to your point earlier as well, I'm surprised he took what sounds like a nightmare shoot, like you said, and
yeah, form, like how do you cut that together?
And form together this perfect 3-act structure that really moves well, and on top of that has the most amazing action I've ever seen.
Yeah.
And it's the same way I felt watching Fury Road as when I watched Maverick, right? It's like these real stunts, it just literally blew my mind. And so for me, it's a gut thing. It's a full on, beyond my intellectualism and my love of structure, it's a gut thing. I didn't have the gut reaction to Furiosa that I did to Fury Road. Just flat out, beyond my brain, my full body reaction was like, okay, you know, and
this is fine.
But seriously, that's it. I think beyond any kind of intellectual discussion, that's just how I felt, right? It's like coming out, it's like, I wanted to love it 100% so much. I'm going and I'm like, I want this to be the movie.
You were more hyped for it than I was.
I mean, Fury Road is like it's the Bible to me. It's like a perfect film. It's a perfect film that we would all love to make.
It's your Ben-Hur.
It is. It was just like, it's everything I want in movies in one fucking movie. It's absolutely perfect. And so for me, like a lot of people said, that's the only and I think if Furiosa came out in 2015 before Fury Road, we'd be having a much different discussion right now.
What do you mean?
I would be saying, wow, what a great, amazing first film in, you know, 30 years later. I think the fact that it's coming after Fury Road, a film that I hold in such high regard, even trying to put it in this, which I agree with you, this kind of Kill Bill Volume 2 thing, even intellectualizing it, I just can't like it as much. I don't think it's just going to work that way for me.
So besides the Praetorian Jack stuff, what else actually worked for you in the movie?
I mean, again, everything with Hemsworth. I think that when he's on screen, I really liked,
he's almost like, as much as I love him in this movie, he's almost in his own movie. Like, he's doing something so totally different from everybody else who's on screen. He's so big. But again, it plays into that, like, whole, the villains of these films create these personas because that's what they have to do in order to lead.
And he's the most peacocking of all of them because, a Morton Joe in both films is, like, behind this mask and very menacing. Humongous is this, heavy breathing, like, kind of strangely quiet, too, when he's not screaming.
Nobody gets out alive.
Toe Cutter is this weird, like, animalistic when he wants to be, but, like...
He's almost Shakespearean.
Yeah.
Like, the way he delivers, he has such a distinct... line delivery in that movie.
Oh, from MX?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. But then he'll he'll hiss.
Yeah.
You know,
literally
hiss at the screen or hiss at a Max. And I think Dementis is, I mean, remember the trailer? Like, I remember, like, what, like, because in my, I didn't know he was the villain. I thought he was going to be like a love, in my mind, who would be the love interest of young Furiosa? Fucking Chris Hemsworth. Like, duh. And
then he shows up with that fucking nose.
The nose and the teeth, you know, and he's doing a thing from he's doing this Christ Messiah thing too with like this cape. And I was reading this article about you can track the story of the film by how dirty his cape is. It's this kind of cool,
It's his beard too.
Yeah.
If you notice, his beard goes from red to gray by the time we're out because it spans almost 20 years.
Yeah. And he also gets sprayed with the red cloud. It's he's blessed by it. And again, there's all kinds of stuff that, I don't hate this movie and I'm actually excited to see it probably twice more in the theater. Cause George Miller is still my fucking dude. And there's stuff in this. Oh, I also really, really liked the opening with her mom.
That sniper sequence
that was
so
fucking
great.
Dope because Volvolini's are one of the coolest parts of Fury Road. Just these sniper badass female bikers who just never they're one shot one man, one shot one kill. It's just dropping dudes a mile away. It's fucking awesome. And to see her mom barefoot in this just green dress with a rifle. And I love the scene too of the idea of she takes the wheel off her bike, puts it on this new bike. It's faster. Mm-hmm. It's he really leans into that kind of, it's all about, but he almost birthed the survival horror genre where the importance of resource management, right? Of everything you watch on the screen, when they find that water, when they find that one more tank of gas, you feel the need to conserve. And one shotgun shell could mean the difference between life and death. You know,
it goes back to that video game logic, too.
That's what I'm saying. The video game survival horror, Resident Evil.
Yeah, just collecting
Silent Hill
on the world map.
Absolutely. Just finding it, breaking open an old barrel and finding five bullets could mean the difference between a zombie eating you.
I did a Morton Joe showing up in this too, because I feel like they do something interesting with that character to where you actually watch a Morton Joe kind of process and strategize in this, where he's just kind of a big blustery asshole who is thrown into this chase. Because again, Fury Road's just one long chase movie from basically 10 minutes in until the end. And a Morton Joe even joins that chase. So really that's all you see him doing. You don't see him strategizing or leading or plotting. Here you kind of do, especially in the scene where she comes back after having her third or fourth run in with Dementis, losing her arm, losing Praetorian Jack, all this stuff. And that you see her bring this information to a Morton Joe and how he's okay, well, how do we go after them then?
Well, it's
again, a deepening of the world and the characters that you've seen before.
Well, and just the relationship between the three towns, right? Of Gastown, Bullet Town and the Citadel, you know, that it's this by Fury Road time, they're all in harmony, right? Because he's put his own guy there to run Gastown. He and the Bullet Farmer are
friendly.
Well,
that's kind of the plot of this movie. If there is a plot to Furiosa, is that Dementis's whole role is almost as a usurper. He wants to undermine and even overthrow a Morton Joe and become the leader of the Wasteland by basically taking power of Gastown, the Bullet Farm, and eventually use that to essentially overthrow the Citadel. But it's like this war that Furiosa kind of finds, again, to take it back to the samurai, she's like the Yojimbo. Yeah. Like she finds herself kind
That's
of
a good exact
going
analogy.
Between yeah. sides in it. But like, I still don't understand if I had a complaint about it. I still don't understand how it works because like the bullet farm. Do they make bullets there or do they just store them?
I think
Gastown looks like just a, is that just a giant oil refinery?
So the lake around it is just oil.
Yeah.
It's like, it's just oil that's being, it's literally like a
being
huge,
sucked up, a huge, and refined.
Yeah. And then the, obviously the water, it's just, I mean, I imagine the old sewers that are.
But it's just like she, we're pre a Morton Joe kind of fully taking over everything because it seems like. He unites all three after
yeah.
Dementis is, I guess, spoiler alert, taken out in the end.
Well, that's what's, I think, one of my favorite moments, too, is when they go to drop produce off at Gastown and Dementis is there. And, again, there's a lot of Trump stuff going on, I think, in this movie. And it's not
Hidden.
And I think Dementis has that thing as well, where he's this guy who's talked a big game. He's taking control of Gastown, but he's failing miserably at it. Like, he can't do, like, they come there and it's all chaos. Like, he doesn't know how to run a civilization.
No, yeah.
Like, it's that kind of thing, too, is like, all
it's his
he
has, casino to all, bankrupt.
Seriously, all he has is bluster, right? He's this guy, it's like, he can destroy and he can usurp, but once it actually comes to running things, like a Morton Joe is a politician. Like a Morton Joe knows how. So it is these ways of like power and how men and people.
Well, they also talk about a Morton Joe. And if you look at his, again, it's in kind of the detail and the action to where you're kind of drawing in the backstory yourself. Like a Morton Joe has all those medals and stuff on his clear kind of armor that yeah. he suits up
like
with.
Chest piece.
But, like, and I think at one point they even referred to him as that he was a colonel at some point.
Yeah.
So he obviously comes from, like, a military background. In the same way that, like, again, details-wise, like, Lord Humongous had that weird, like, dirty, hairy style, like, handgun that has the scope on it.
And like,
but if you see him take it out of the case and stuff, it almost seems like a relic that was handed down from, like, World War II or World War III or something.
Yeah.
Which makes you wonder.
Like a general's gift.
Yeah, if it was, like, a generational thing or if he came from, like, a military family or background or whatever. Like, again, it's, like, it's you trying to fill in the blanks with, like, these weird things that these. Because who knows? Lord Humongous might have just killed some motherfucker along the way and been like, oh, this gun in this box looks cool. I'm going to keep it for myself. But like, it does seem like these guys at least hold on to fragments of their own past when creating this persona that helps them navigate the wasteland. And Morton Joe in particular seems like he was an old military guy.
Well, and it's just thematically linked to Furiosa, the whole her keeping the seed, too, that we're all carrying something
yeah.
from the past. Like, we're all carrying something to keep alive, or not, you know, and she's this, like, very easy symbolism of, like, of hope, right, is, like, can something grow again?
Which, again, to bring it back to the whole, like, deepening, one movie deepens another movie, I think when you realize what she was carrying the whole time and where it actually ends up by the end of Furiosa, when you get to that scream in Fury Road, it makes it hit all the more harder after you've seen Furiosa because you're like, she didn't just lose the green plate. She lost the thing that she carried her entire life and that basically defined her.
Yeah. No, I agree. And I think that like I watched Fury Road before I went and saw Furiosa, and I think what I'm going to do probably the next week is, and I'm always ready to watch Fury Road again, is I'm just going to like go see Furiosa, come home immediately.
That's what I did.
And just like put it on.
Because I hadn't gotten to Fury Road yet, but I didn't know when I was going to be able to work it in before we recorded. So I was like, you know what? it's technically a prequel. Just go watch Furiosa and then watch Fury Road. And that's what I did. And I was like, this is the best decision ever. Like, this rules so fucking hard. And now I can't separate the two. To me, now they are, for more or less, if you could come up with a new name other than the whole bloody affair, like if you were to put Furiosa and Fury Road together, like that's George Miller's The Whole Bloody Affair. Like, it's just, this is what it is now.
And I know he wants to do a Mad Max The Wasteland film, I believe, is the one he's talked about.
Yeah, that's the one he's kicked around. But honestly, after the performance of this one, and he's 80 years old, like, I would highly doubt we get another Mad Max.
It took him 9 years to do this, 30 to do the last one. Yeah. So
could you imagine being like 86 and out in the middle of Namibia trying to crash tanker trucks together? I sure couldn't.
I mean, I think George Miller could do it. I think he and Ridley are out there taking her easy for all us sinners, fucking blowing shit up.
Yeah. I mean, if it gets us another Furiosa, I say do it, George.
Well, that's the thing, is as much as I didn't like think it's the greatest, I want more. Like, there's no part of me. It's like, please give me more, Mr.
Miller. Daddy George.
Please, Daddy George.
Will you give me another?
Please, sir, I want some more.
Some more fish and chips in the wasteland. Well, Martin, this has been great.
Indeed.
Even though your opinion on Furiosa is incorrect, this has been a really good installment of the podcast where we got to wax rhapsodic about one of our favorite film series. We've been doing this a lot lately. We got Planet of the Apes. We got this.
We got a couple more coming up.
We got a couple more coming up. I actually had one that I thought about at the event that we were doing tonight, where I was like, why haven't we done this yet? But I guess you're going to have to stay tuned to find out what that is on Secret Handshake.
See you next time.
Bye.
Coming. All else are castles building.